This is Eric Lambert, Associate General Counsel at Jostens, and you're listening to IP Fridays.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
Welcome to episode 36 of IP Fridays, where we have a great interview with Eric Lambert, who is Associate General Counsel at Jostens, and where we get to peek behind the curtain with regard to the IP strategy of Jostens, and we will hear his views on trade secret protection and copyright and privacy and many other interesting issues. Then we have a story about a patent battle over gene silencing. And last but not least, some information on whether the Kit Kat chocolate bar is protectable as a 3D mark. Nestlé, who is producer of the famous Kit Kat chocolate bar, has applied for a 3D trademark for their chocolate bar without any branding, so the chocolate bar itself. The trademark application has been originally filed with the UK Intellectual Property Office and has so far been refused by the different instances, just like the High Court in the UK. And now this case is pending at the European Court of Justice. Advocate General has just released an interesting opinion on June 11, 2015. Most people who commented on this case so far interpreted the case that the Advocate General is saying that the finger shape of the unbranded Kit Kat bar will not be registrable as a trademark in the UK for lack of proof of acquired distinctiveness. However, the famous blog IPCAT, or other people call it IPCAT, had an interesting post on their website on August 30th, 2015, where I found out that the case is not as simple as it seems. There were two questions posed on the European Court of Justice by the High Court, and the second question is a little bit odd to people outside the UK, as it says, whether the applicant had to prove that a significant proportion of the relevant class of persons relies upon the mark, as opposed to any other trademarks, which they may also be present, as indicating the origin of the goods. Yes, you have heard correctly. The question was whether the relevant public would rely upon the trademark as an indication of the origin. And the funny thing is that the Advocate General of the European Court of Justice just simply avoided any reference to the reliance criterion, so that the readers would think that he is not really thinking that the reliance criterion is needed in his view. Nevertheless, he was of the opinion that the trademark could not be registered. And that seemed a little odd, since Nestlé has submitted survey evidence showing that more than 50% of the interviews, just on seeing the shape alone, were sure that the product had an exclusive and unique commercial origin in the applicant. My fellow blogger Jeremy Phillips over at the IPCAT rightfully asks at the end of his article, what else could be required to establish an acquired distinctiveness? If you want to read the full article, which is quite interesting, you can head over to www.ipfridays.com/kitkat, K-I-T-K-A-T, ipfridays.com/kitkat. Now, Ken had the chance to interview Eric Lambert, who is Associate General Counsel at Jostens. And after the interview, I will tell you about a big patent battle over silencing genes. Ken, take it away.
Rolf, I am pleased to be joined by Eric Lambert, Associate General Counsel at Jostens, Inc., located right here in the state of Minnesota. At Jostens, Eric is responsible for digital and e-commerce matters, digital and mobile marketing, contract negotiation and drafting, privacy issues, technology licensing, commercial agreements, compliance, export, litigation management, dispute resolution, and risk management. In addition, Eric is a certified information privacy professional. Prior to joining Jostens, Eric served as Associate General Counsel at Digital River, a company also located in Minnesota. Eric graduated summa cum laude from the University of Rochester in 1992, where he also earned the distinction of graduating Phi Beta Kappa. He completed his legal studies at Cornell Law School in 1995. In his free time, Eric's other talents shine in local theatrical productions. Eric is also known for his voiceover skills. Welcome, Eric, to IP Fridays.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Eric. Eric, what's the in-house perspective on relying on trade secret protection for a proprietary company information instead of patent or other intellectual property protection?
Well, I think that the biggest issue that I've run into with relying on trade secret protection versus other protections is the lack of employees' understanding of what a company's trade secrets really are relative to their company's confidential information or proprietary information. A company, many times, you know, companies obviously in their non-disclosure agreements usually have a finite period in which confidential information is kept confidential. Some, not as many as probably should, also will include a carve-out for trade secrets. But in many cases, companies don't do a good job of identifying exactly what their trade secrets are versus what's just simply doesn't rise to the level of trade secret, but is still confidential information or proprietary information. Without that explanation, it can become very easy for an employee to inadvertently, you know, cause a company to lose its trade secret protection.
Interesting.
That's why I'm very hesitant to rely on trade secret protection for anything that truly is sensitive and valuable property for the company.
Mm-hmm. What's one thing you think many companies overlook when it comes to their intellectual property protections?
You know, one thing I think that many companies don't really think about, especially non-tech companies, is protecting the source code in their software programs. It's very easy to register copyrights with the U.S. Copyright Office in source code, even if your source code is considered a trade secret. U.S. Copyright Office actually has a specific procedure by which you can submit for recordation a computer program containing trade secrets, and you don't have to produce your entire code base in order to avail yourself of statutory damages in the event of infringement. So I think that's one thing that a lot of companies tend to overlook, but I think it's a very important thing for companies to consider, especially if they happen to be in a particular industry or area where, you know, companies just copy. I mean, the adage is imitation is the sincerest form of copyright infringement, and and source code is publicly available generally in many cases, especially for web apps and things like that. And it can be beneficial to ensure you have as much protection as possible.
And what advantages would the company have if they did register their source code?
Well, by registering the source code, you have the ability to avail yourself of statutory damages in certain cases of infringement, which can be somewhat substantial and can quite honestly be a very large stick to try and drive a company to cease infringement and to cease using the proprietary source code of that company.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful. Do you use inventor questionnaires in your work over at Jostens?
You know, we do. We actually have a two-phase approach. We start with a new invention questionnaire, which is really a one-page, very short, five or six questionnaire, just which allows us to do an initial assessment, kind of a knockout review, to ensure, for example, that it isn't something that they invented recently, but they've been talking about and disclosing for, you know, that doesn't meet the one-year bar. Make sure we understand if it involves third-party software, hardware, systems, listing out all, make sure we understand who all the inventors are, understanding what differentiates it from what's out there. That can allow us, like I said, one, to, you know, do that initial knockout, but also gives us some relevant information to do a deeper dive and decide, is this something worth considering for a provisional application? Is this something that's important enough to consider a full application out of the gate? We find that can be very helpful, and it's important to tie that to a recognition program for the inventors. I think, you know, it's important for these the people that are actually inventing things on behalf of the company to feel recognized when they do something that really results in the creation of valuable intellectual property for the company. So I think making sure you tie that in, it's an important aspect of that program.
Sure. Let's turn our attention to the cloud. What are your biggest concerns today when engaging a cloud service provider?
You know, there's a lot of them. I think a lot of the times in companies that I've worked for and that I've spoken with other people, the decision to move to a cloud provider is often driven by cost and by wear and tear on IT resources. And often overlooked are a lot of the legal risks and concerns that go into that. It's obviously the legal, you know, the kind of the risk management aspect of that from a legal perspective is not a driving factor, but it's an important factor in ensuring a company is making an informed decision. Some of the issues that can come up are, you know, jurisdictional issues in terms of where the data is being stored. Certainly from a privacy and security perspective, understanding is your data going to be separated logically or partitioned on a server from data of other customers? Understanding how they will handle and how they can respond to a document preservation notice should you be sued, subpoenas, items like this that are very important to explore. And a lot of times, you know, these, you know, cloud service companies have very standard form contracts and it's hard to get them to change. But I think as companies start to ask these questions and push back more, we will hopefully see a continued attention by the cloud service companies to addressing these potential risks to the greatest extent they can to make sure that companies feel more comfortable and their attorneys feel more comfortable moving in the direction of the cloud.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eric, you do a lot of contract drafting, and when you're drafting contracts, do you use IP reps, IP warranties, or both?
You know, in most cases, I use both, but I try to ensure that they play well together. I'm always sensitive to the argument from the other side about double dipping, you know, seeking both indemnification and breach of warranty claims. But, you know, the importance of the warranty can be in establishing, you know, an innocent infringer defense and showing that you didn't have, there was no willful infringement. At the same time, you want to avoid an instance where you're then going to, like I said, be able to double dip. So usually when I include an IP representation, I'll often tie the exclusive remedy for breach of the representation to the indemnification provided in the indemnification section, which I find usually placates any questions that might arise relating to it. But it just gives us the benefit of both.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of pushback when you do that, or what's the general tenor when you make those changes?
Not too much. I mean, I generally try and lead with that language in many cases. And so I will receive the occasional question of why do you have both? But usually once I've explained it, and in some cases I will provide a little bit of a pre-explanation. In some contracts that I'll do, I'll try and include an FAQ, especially if it's a non-standard e-commerce and an internet-based contract, to explain some of the concepts. And that's one that I have done in the past to explain. And I find that generally, once it's been explained, there's very little pushback on that provision.
Good. Are you a proponent of feedback clauses in contracts?
You know, I am if they're used carefully. This ties into, you know, when we're talking about trade secrets, a feedback clause is another way for, you know, a company's intellectual property to sneak out the back door. You know, in many cases, the feedback clause simply says that if I provide feedback, the other side has an unfettered, perpetual, irrevocable right to use that for their business. If employees aren't careful and let something out that's confidential, trade secret, otherwise, you know, protectable company IP in feedback, it can create a very difficult position of what wins, the feedback license or the confidentiality or ownership language in a contract. What I'll try and do in many cases is ensure that a feedback clause specifically exempts any information that's been designated as confidential under the agreement to eliminate that issue.
Interesting. Now, the feedback often would come by email, I assume. That's a common thing, people giving their feedback and telephone calls. Does it cover all forms of communication?
It can. I mean, one thing that I've done, and I think is beneficial as well, you know, obviously in many non-disclosure agreements, you'll see clauses where if there's an oral disclosure of confidential information, it needs to be summarized in a written document within a certain amount of time. And I think that a similar type of idea in a feedback clause, can be useful if you want to be very careful about what's provided. But to say that it won't be considered feedback unless it's been summarized and designated as such within a certain amount of time, or unless you can flip it around on, you know, anything that's disclosed, which a party provides in writing, does not constitute feedback, can't be used within a certain period of time.
Let's talk about NDAs. I'm sure you see that often at the company.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that would make you walk away from a non-disclosure agreement?
You know, there's very little. I mean, obviously, the NDA is not when you want to run into a big contractual issue. But the one thing that does come up and has been a major stumbling block in the past are residuals clauses. You know, residuals clause is that clause that says that if, you know, anything that's retained in your unaided memory is considered residuals and is excluded from the definition of confidential information. It's generally just a gigantic backdoor to the non-disclosure agreement. And it's because it's incredibly subjective. It's very difficult to prove what, you know, that something is, you know, wasn't, for example, intentionally memorized and to be instead of just retained in a person's unaided memory. So it can be very, very difficult. And I generally try and shy away from them. I've occasionally seen someone try and flip it around and use it the other way around to basically say that, you know, confidential information includes anything that might be retained in unaided memory or any ideas that might be retained in any know-how you retain you can't use. So I've seen it both ways, but most often it's used as an exclusion, and it's a very dangerous clause, depending on the type of information that you're disclosing to the other party.
Mm-hmm. The last topic I want to talk about today is privacy. I know we've been hearing a lot about it. We've been seeing a lot about it. What's the current hot-button issues that you're seeing when it comes to privacy at the state and federal levels?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that's happened very recently is the FTC has released a guide called Start for Security, a guide for business. One complaint that the FTC has received is that they are exerting jurisdiction over privacy policy violations by companies without really providing them much guidance on what constitutes a deceptive or unfair trade practice when it comes to your privacy policy. The guide that they've put out attempts to provide some guidance essentially by using the Socratic method. They've taken the 50 or so actions that they brought, enforcement actions against companies, and used that to glean what, you know, steps that a company can do and things they can avoid doing to avoid problems. Essentially, they're learning what companies should do by what other companies did wrong. Yep, and there's a lot of useful information. It's a bit high level. But there is a lot of useful information in this for companies to review, and a lot of them track to, other privacy principles. The collection limitation, don't collect more information than you need, don't use it in ways that you're not supposed to, restrict access to sensitive data. You know, there's a lot of good points in here that it's good for companies can use this guide, I think, largely as a sanity check and make sure that their practices and their procedures are in line with this. I think that a company that is in line with this is likely going to be in a better stead if they do have a problem with the FTC.
Now, is that guide available online?
It is. Oh, it's available on the FTC's website.
Excellent. Eric, mm-hmm. Thank you so much today for your participation in today's episode of IP Fridays.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, also from my side. The Boston Globe had an interesting story on a patent battle over silencing genes on August 22, 2015. A researcher at the German Max Planck Institute in Munich, Thomas Tuschel, has discovered a technology where so-called small interfering RNA, in short siRNA, can target all genes, whether they are on the surface of cells or inside the cells. So in theory, any single gene in a cell of about 20,000 genes can be targeted using this technology. And with this technology, genes can be targeted to create drugs for genes that were previously considered undruggable. So understandingly, many pharmaceutical companies are interested in this technology, and the technology seems to be exclusively licensed to a company called Alnylam Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Other players in this field include the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the Whitehead Institute of Biomedical Research, and the University of Massachusetts. Now, a researcher at the University of Utah, Brenda Buss, claims that she had invented this technology before Thomas Tuschl of Max Planck Institute and actually told him about her inventions before Thomas Tuschl had published his papers on this technology. So now she claims co-inventorship, which in turn would have the effect that she or the University of Utah would get a share in the licensing fees. As you can imagine, this is about a lot of money, although in fact there is currently not a single product on the market that uses this technology. Currently, there seem to be two lawsuits pending in the US, one in Utah and one in Boston. And in the Boston case, there was a recent hearing where the US District Chief Judge Patty B. Zaris asked the plaintiff, "You are saying that the inventor Buss gets nothing from here until eternity? Would that be correct?" And the attorney representing Alnylam Pharmaceuticals and the other parties involved says yes, without any hesitation. Many scientists in the field call this technology a breakthrough technology, and it will be interesting how this case will work out. If you want to read the full article, you can head over to www.ipfridays.com/sirna. ipfridays.com/sirna.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or Stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.